639-51, Senate Committee on Judiciary, May 15, 1975, 8 a.m., room 315. Hearing on AMJ Tax Bill 2540, AMJ Tax Bill 2645, and Senate Bill 1014.
2645, Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm in the three administrative reorganization corrections division, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2645. When this bill was before the House Committee on State Institutions, the corrections division appeared to testify in support of the measure as introduced. And it is the position of the Corrections Division that preferably annual reviews by the Board of Parole should be conducted in every case. And this position is based on the fact that continued personal attention by the Board has immediate significance to the men and women in Oregon's felony institutions, and as such, continued contact will tend to foster cooperative planning between the Board and the Division in making proper address of individual program needs. Although the Corrections Division continues to prefer that annual hearings be held, we will support the amendment which calls for biennial hearings. The provisions of House Bill 2645 as amended and presented in the A engrossed version appear to be a reasonable resolution of the issue. In its engrossed version, House Bill 2645 carries the full support of the Corrections Division.
Are there any questions? Mr. Scott is going to testify, I know, but is this agreeable to the parole board?
I can't speak for the parole board, Madam Chairman.
I see. Thank you. Mr. Scott?
My name is Phil Hitchcock. I am a former member of the parole board and presently live in Sisters, Oregon, speaking for myself only. I'd like to subscribe to Mr. Reed's position on this bill. One or two things briefly. I'm not sure how familiar the board is with processes, but the man who comes before the board, having been incarcerated in one of the penal institutions, is heard within 6 months at a preliminary hearing at which a date for a future hearing is set. That future hearing may be in a few months. It may be 8, 10, or 12 years. I think 12 is the longest I have had experience with. This means that unless there is intervention, this man will not be heard by the parole board again for that period of time. The only out he has is if the superintendent of the institution shall so recommend, the board will consider setting an earlier hearing date. Our statistics indicated that in the last year this happened 56% of the time, so that the other 44%, the man is in there for this full period of time without a hearing, without ever seeing the parole board. Now, I think that it's quite obvious and well recognized that hope is an essential to rehabilitation. If a man is put into there and you say to him, we will not even talk to you again for 10 years, this, I'm sure, makes it very difficult for the superintendent of the institution to find programs, for the man to have any hope or any inspiration for being rehabilitated. Two, I'm sure that Mr. Cupp could testify that the people who are a problem in the institution are likely to be those who haven't any hope. And a man who is there on a very long sentence with not much to lose, is likely to be the type of person who is causing trouble and problems in the institution that involve other people in trouble and that may ultimately involve violence. This annual review, the biennial review, I subscribe with Mr. Reed to the fact I would have supported the annual review, but biennial is much, 2 years is much better than 10 or 12. It seems to me that this is two other things. The American Parole Association and the American Corrections Association both endorsed and are working toward the implementation of this procedure in all of the states.
Questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Hitchcock. Mr. Newell?
Members of the committee, my name is Bill Newell. I'm chairman of the Oregon State Board of Parole. As Mr. Hitchcock has covered considerable ground, will not burden you this morning. The present board is in favor of 2645, the biannual review. Also, Mr. Johnson, who is previous member of the board from 1969 till last year, was in favor of a biannual review. So I will not. Is there any questions?
Thank you very much, sir. Turn to 1014, Mr. Reed.
Madam Chairman and members of the board, Amos Reed, the Administrator of the Oregon Corrections Division. The Corrections Division is opposed to the provisions of Senate Bill 1014, which eliminates all hope for persons sentenced to life terms without possibility for release. The Oregon Constitution in Article 1, Section 15 provides, quote, laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the principles of reformation and not of vindictive justice, end quote. The Corrections Division position is based on this constitutional provision and operates on the belief that offenders who are placed in correctional programs require individual planning covering the entire array of options. Certain violence-prone individuals constitute a threat to the safety of others. These people require long-term incarceration, and we have a number of these people in Oregon prisons at the present time. In fact, I think it's something like 122. A majority do not have long-term incarceration needs, and all prisoners are most likely to change for the better in an atmosphere of optimism and hope. However far removed, that hope of release may be even at the present time under existing practices. For example, we have one man in the Oregon State Prison who's been there for 33 years right now. When every prisoner has some hope for eventual release, the responsibility for acceptable behavior can be placed fully with each prisoner. If some prisoners have no hope for ever being released, the safety of the victims, police, prosecutors, judges, prison workers, volunteers, and other prisoners is placed in real and imminent jeopardy. The entire practice of involving the community in the practice of corrections would be of necessity eliminated or much reduced. Great violence could result during commission of crimes and in all processes thereafter if this bill passes. The experiences in other jurisdictions outside Oregon is testimony to what happens when the criminal justice system is totally unforgiving. The corrections process in Oregon would revert to practices it has taken 10 to 15 years to ameliorate. Looking at prisoners as human beings with needs is not a task that comes about with ease. Human nature and tradition dictate that those who commit crimes are punished. Corrections practitioners must be professionals who fulfill society's mandates without personalizing and internalizing that assignment. This bill, which would designate one group of offenders as a class apart, would verify that some prisoners should be punished without giving recognition to individual circumstances. Examination of the recent notorious and heinous crimes will reveal mistakes were made in the exercise of individual judgment. Rules and regulations exist which provide for adequate community safety considerations in work release and temporary leave decisions. Rules to ensure corrections division endorsement at the administrator's level for all matters addressed in this bill would be an alternative preferable to the provisions of the bill. The legislative mandate of Corrections Division rules to preclude community placement of dangerous individuals is preferred and could accomplish the same result without the brutalizing effect of mandating no hope for the people involved. The Corrections Division is willing to develop such rules if it would be of interest to the committee. A I might also point out that as we understand this, this document and from our legal counsel, we wouldn't even be permitted to take a man off or a woman off the grounds for medical treatment. We would not be able to transfer them to state hospitals. In fact, we wouldn't be able to take them to the court under the specifics of this bill. And Madam Chairman, we recommend very strongly that this bill not be enacted into law. The internal management of a prison is the most unusual environment. It's supercharged. And if we have men there and women who have absolutely no hope, they have nothing to lose whatsoever in their depredations and in their violence within the prison. And if the average life of a person coming into the prison is 30 to 35 years, and if we're getting 15 to 20 of these a year, you can see what we would have at the end of 20 or 30 years. We could very well wind up with a prison of 400 to 600 lifers, all without any hope whatsoever. And I think any thinking rational person only has to use their imagination as to what kind of a place that would be. Thank you.
Question? In your opinion, are there some individuals in our present state of knowledge who probably should never be released?
Yes.
How would you suggest we identify these people?
In the main, these persons are identifiable and are identified. However, the absolute and precise and scientific prediction of human behavior is faulty. A person who would appear to be predictable as a violent person may go out and never commit any kind of a violent crime, whereas someone who is predicted to be nonviolent may go out and commit a crime. In the main, those who are in the category that I think the chairman is thinking of, if I understand your question, these are the individuals who fall into one of two or three categories, variously described as crystallized character disorders, whose problems go back with a long taproot to early childhood, giving evidence of bizarre and extreme behavior, even in early childhood through adolescence, with a long history of crime. There are those other individuals who do not seem to surface during their childhood period, and then commit one of the heinous crimes that indicates that the individual, while not psychotic, knowing full well where they are in time and place, have a capacity for engaging in the most extreme and bizarre, brutal, sadistic kinds of crimes. In the prison jargon, they usually refer to them as the weird ones. Now, there are these individuals who, by the very extreme nature of their crime, communicate that their problem is not an ordinary problem, and that our science and art are so faulty that in the protection of the general community that these individuals should not be returned into the foreseeable future with the state of the arts what they are. As in medicine, we always work hopefully. We always work with the thought that somewhere, sometime, we may be able to come up with some specific understanding. We're confronted with something that's even perhaps more serious than a malignant tumor, advanced cancer that confronts a physician. But we do work hopefully, and we try to communicate hope. But these, the extremes of these individuals, the most dangerous of the individuals, are recognizable.
Do you know what the, you said you had one prisoner for 33 years. Do you know what his original time was? The problem to a prison, or is he in the life of
murdered
law?
Two.
Murdered two. How, in a hypothetical case,
if you had a man who had committed a brutal murder of a woman, similar to the Fox situation that happened here and had been in prison, he would obviously seem to have some kind of psychological problem dealing with women. How are you ever going to identify that when he's never put into a situation where you can observe him?
I have to be very, very careful, Madam Chairman, in addressing this issue and can only speak in hypothetical terms. It is our collective judgment in the Corrections Division that the planning for such individuals should go forward as a master planning effort, and the various components of the governmental agencies and the private agencies should work together in common purpose, and that no one segment or one individual or one part of this should go forward in isolation. It is our belief that in this kind of a situation that we should move collectively, the collective wisdom, all of our experience together, all the superintendents and chiefs and the parole board, in concert with the judges and district attorneys and the police and the private agencies, that we distill the wisdom, so to speak, of the group. Now, in the instance, I can think of a case back in Chicago where there was an individual who committed heinous crimes against other persons and dismembered the bodies and so on. Now, really, there is not a necessity for a long, deep psychological study to know that that person is a most unusual and dangerous person, and probably will be the remainder of their life. There seems to be, in our culture, in our government, in our society, an over-expectation of the precision of psychiatry and psychology as a science. I think this is regrettable. Not that much of a science. The practitioners of psychiatry on the national level have acknowledged that individually they have not the capacity to precisely predict violent human behavior. That their best predictions are made in concert with other people, and by others I mean across the scene, everyone working with an individual, the different agencies and so on. We feel in corrections that this includes the officers in the institution, the nurses, the teachers, and everybody else who is working with an individual. And that this folk wisdom, this collective wisdom, distilled, would give the community the best that we know how to give. Now, it would not be infallible, but there's nothing in human endeavor that is infallible. Even if we pass the law, somebody can violate the law, if you follow. Mm-hmm. It does come down to human judgment and to human decision.
Well, you have said that you recognize that there are certain people in our present state of knowledge who should never be released. And this decision under this bill would be made by a judge, not you. And so what you're really saying is that you have a prison management problem if you get this type of individual, is that right?
The most serious prison management problem. And while I have deep respect for the courts are not generally learned in the behavioral sciences. And they have a dependence upon others. Their knowledge generally in making decisions on the human behavior is one that is dependent upon the advice and counsel that comes to them from the same people that I have been discussing. Learning people in the law, yes. But the management of these individuals goes really beyond the toe chain of a legal person alone. I would not exclude the judges, nor would I exclude the district attorneys and the others in the decision-making process. But I think this could be done by rule rather than by law, and without nailing the door to, so to speak, with railroad spikes, where an individual has no hope whatsoever and has nothing to lose by murdering in the prison, creating disturbance in the prison. And believe me, we have enough problems as it is under the conditions that we operate right now with the limited resources and the limited science and art and dealing with human beings. Our staff are human too. And I'm being redundant, I think that the best policy is one that insists upon the decision being spread across a body of people rather than for it to be left alone just to the corrections division or just to the parole board. And I believe that this can be done by rules rather than by law.
Well, could you explain to me more what you would do with the rules? What are you proposing?
Well, for one thing, as you know, we had another situation which involved a dangerous person going out into the community. Now, there were verbal communications that were then finalized into written, precise rules of policy and procedure, which required the input from all superintendents and all chiefs for persons to go on work or education release, those persons who had committed any of the heinous crimes and clearly represented a potential for dangerous conduct. Personally, I think the same thing should be done here. This would mean that the parole board would have to share its decision-making independence with the corrections division. It's my personal opinion and that of the chief of the corrections division that this is one instance. And I have, where this should be done, and I have communicated this verbally for about 10 years, that this is my personal opinion, that in dealing with these very dangerous people, and you can think back over the past few years where certain names have been mentioned, that is my personal belief that the parole board should not go forward in total independence at that point in time, but should move with these cases in total concert and upon the advice and counsel of the corrections division. And not having that, they should not go forward, in my opinion.
Well, now that would require a statutory change.
No, it could be, well, yes. To the extent that you would mandate that such rules be promulgated by the administrator of the corrections division. Because presently, the independence of the board is separate from that of the corrections division.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you.
President Ball?
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 1014, recognizing that the committee has a great deal of work left to do on some of the conceptual matters that are involved in it. But we have recently witnessed several tragic incidents in which persons formerly sentenced to life imprisonment have been released and then accused of brutal and murder of innocent persons. These tragic incidents have reawakened questions regarding the efficacy of the sentencing and parole procedures in Oregon. I have received almost 200 letters in the past several weeks from concerned citizens who are asking that the death penalty be reinstated in Oregon. At present, 32 states in the United States have revived such statutes after they were nullified in the 1972 United States Supreme Court decision of Furman versus Georgia. The present mood of the country seems to support overwhelmingly the reinstatement of the death penalty. The death penalty in Oregon and elsewhere has been cyclical, dependent upon societal attitude changes for its effect. The provision mandating the death penalty for first-degree murders was first codified in Oregon in 1864. This provision was overturned in 1914 when the people of Oregon approved an amendment to the Oregon Constitution which abolished the death penalty. This amendment was in turn repealed by an act of the 1920 special session of the Oregon legislature which reinstated the death penalty and was referred to the people of the state and approved. Our present law stems from a constitutional amendment which was adopted by the people of the state in 1964 and again repealed capital punishment. There are therefore no provisions at this time which allow for capital punishment for any crime in this state at this time. I think the history of the death penalty in Oregon demonstrates very aptly the cyclical nature of capital punishment in this state and in this nation. It has twice been in effect. It moves to implement capital punishment provisions seem to have always followed on the heels of particularly brutal and violent murders. and appears that Oregon is at that place in the cycle where the people are ready to act to reinstate the death penalty. This is borne out by the volume of mail which I, and I'm sure all of you, have received on this particular subject. I do not favor the death penalty, and believe that it would be a great mistake to attempt to implement such a measure at this time. The death penalty has historically and demonstrably discriminated against the poor, the dispossessed, and the minorities. I also believe that the taking of life is wrong, no matter what the circumstances. The cyclical nature, as I see the death penalty and the evolutionary process which it tends to go through, is what I would consider to be in a moving cycle. It's a slowly moving cycle. If we plug into that cycle at one given point, let's say we're particularly at the point we're in right now, where particularly brutal deaths of innocent people have occurred, public opinion peaks, and society and the legislature and the people react to that and reinstate the death penalty. The death penalty comes back, and year by year it goes on, and fewer people are put to death, and soon we are left only with minorities, poor, and other unfortunate people that are on death row. And society then says this can't be right, because if a person can afford good legal health, it seems that he or that person does not receive the death penalty, no matter what his crime. He's put away from society and put into prison, but he does not receive the death penalty. And so society perceives that this is wrong, that this is not fair, what has happened with the death penalty. And so then they vote to abolish the death penalty. The present status of the, as I understand, of the Supreme Court case is such that the Supreme Court is expected to act on the North Carolina case sometime in the next few months, the next several months. Illustrative of the problem that I think exists is that of the 17 men on death row in the state of North Carolina awaiting the decision now of the Supreme Court, all 17 are black. I think it's illustrative of the problem. They will be deciding on the constitutionality of the death penalty within the next several months. And I believe that if the state were at this time to revive the death penalty by constitutional amendment, we would be risking its invalidation before it could ever come into effect. And Oregon would still be left without any ways or means to deal with certain class of murderers from whom society has every right to be defended in a more substantial manner than is presently afforded through existing law or the parole system. I believe that Senate Bill 1014 offers a better resolution. The bill sets up a mechanism whereby a sentencing judge can determine those persons who, by depraved and unspeakable conduct, have evidenced their inability to neither conform to the laws of society nor to the ancient Judaic law of thou shalt not kill. This bill gives the sentencing judge the discretion to impose a mandatory life sentence on a person convicted of heinous murder. Such a sentence would mean that a person would be imprisoned for the rest of his natural life with no possibility of parole or release. Following a conviction for murder, the trial judge would hold a hearing at which evidence would be received both from the defendant and the state pertaining to the rehabilitative potential of the criminal. The sentencing judge would weigh this evidence and determine whether or not the convicted murderer should be sentenced to life imprisonment or life imprisonment with no possibility of parole. A sentence of life imprisonment is presently required for persons convicted of murder, but in reality, they can be, although often are not, released from prison in a little more than 7 years. The bill would also redefine murder to include only intentional murder and murder under the felony murder doctrine. Therefore, the third definition of murder in ORS 163.115, murder committed recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, would not be subject to the provisions of the bill. I believe this proposal is a workable and effective compromise. It reflects the mood of the citizens of this state regarding the excesses of the parole system. It goes relatively far to protect society from murderers who indicate propensities for committing further capital crimes. It provides a frightening deterrent to those who might contemplate such acts. It affords society the opportunity to correct potential jury or courtroom mistakes, an opportunity not available in the case of the death penalty. The judicial review in the case of new and compelling evidence of a person sentenced under this act will need to be carefully studied and amplified by the committee over and above what is in the bill at the present time. On the whole, I believe that Oregon's correction system is an exemplary one. Recent statistics show that the rehabilitative goal aspired to by the Oregon correction system is being achieved. In the most recent figures released by the Corrections Division of the Department of Human Resources, only 5.9% of the persons released within the last 24 months by the Corrections Division have been recommitted for subsequent crime. I wholeheartedly support the idea of rehabilitation in our parole system. I believe, however, that there are certain cases in which rehabilitation is not possible. It is not the goal. The rehabilitative goal set for the majority of our prison population is simply not appropriate to certain persons. This fact has been painfully borne out by the events of late. In these cases, it is not rehabilitation, but the protection of innocent society that must be the goal. There are those who will challenge this proposal as creating a practical problem of prison security. If a person is committed to life imprisonment with no possibility of parole, he will not, unlike most other prisoners, be on exemplary behavior because there will be no possibility of parole for him. He may become desperate and repeatedly attempt to escape. He may also attempt to create his own fiefdom within the prison walls, which he will rule by strong-arm tactics, the well-known case of the boss con, if you will. Certainly, such a tyranny of the prison by an inmate cannot and must not be supported. These possibilities will have to be obviated by those in the Corrections Division or by the Senate Committee on the Judiciary may arrive at a statutory solution. Or, in fact, arrangements might possibly be made with the federal penal institutions, which arrangements could be made for them to accept this type of prisoner if they have superior facilities for taking care of such prisoners. I am painfully aware of the initial problems caused by a bill such as this. It seems to go against the entire tenor of the penal system in this state, but it seems to be the only means available to protect society from incidents similar to those of the last few weeks. In attempting to protect the rights of criminals, we must not lose sight of the rights of members of society to continue to live peacefully and securely. We must balance the rights of society against the rights of the criminals and determine that the rights of society must prevail. In such cases, the inalienable rights of members of society far outweigh the forfeited rights of the convicted felon. I would ask your support for the bill. Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
I would
recommend to you some very enlightened reading if you have a chance. I know you probably won't. This particular book by Daniel Glasser on the effectiveness of a prison and parole. It seems to me that the question really boils down to the parole board, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to hear all of Amos' testimony that preceded mine, but it seemed to me as I came in on the last that he was driving at this, that this thing is too sensitive to be simply left any longer to the discretion of a parole board that may have a majority of putting heads on it, as we seem to have had in the past, the present parole board accepted as far as I know, but in some of the past ones I think that they have the course of actions that they have taken has been proved to be very, very ill-advised. And it seems to me that with the cases that we've had, particularly right here in Marion County, which amazed me a little bit about the editorial in the Morning Statesman, which said in editorializing against this bill, the caption of the editorial is, "Don't throw away the key." Well, I'm suggesting that we do throw the key away in certain cases. That we don't keep that key and offer it out there so that we see in the public, not only in this community, in this county, but all over the state, just shakes and trembles a little bit every time Jerome Brutus makes a move towards the parole board or towards extra legal procedures that may acquire him his freedom. I think it's time we maybe throw a key away, and I suggest we can't have it both ways. We can't have a statesman editorial one day saying, don't bring back the death penalty, don't overreact, don't be a demagogue and bring back the death penalty. And at the same time say, let's do nothing to make sure that society, as far as we are able, is protected from pathological killers.
Some questions?
Sure.
Amos,
Reed mentioned that the decision of whether or not to give parole by the judge is really not a very good idea, because the judge may be adequate to law, but he's not very adequate in measuring an inmate's precaution on rehabilitation. I recognize that this bill gives
may be another way. In considering this bill, we thought a lot about perhaps leading it up to jury determination. Because when the jury is impaneled and sitting there, then maybe the 12 men, good and true, would have that responsibility of weighing the evidence. It seemed to me, on reflection, that, well, we all know judges aren't perfect, neither are juries. And a judge would be able to look at this situation far more unemotionally, far more objectively, with a great deal more background and experience than could a jury, for example. If you go some other way, if you leave it to a different type of board, I don't know who that would be, and I don't know how it would fit into the legal system, how you could impose such a sentence on a person without it being within the ultimate province of the judge-jury, the courtroom situation, to make that determination of a mandatory life sentence.
What would you think about the mandatory sentence and then allowing the compilation that you read of the various departments, including DAs and judges and all of the correction people, reviewing the matter in 10 years, giving the man hope that in the review there may be an opportunity for parole, but bringing in just more than the parole board for these identifiable problems.
This is a possibility along with this. I agree that that one of the advantages of this system over capital punishment is simply that society does have the opportunity to redress a mistake that's made in the courtroom by the jury, by the judge, by whoever. And if there is new evidence, compelling evidence of drastic behavior change, I suspect that ought to be worked into it somewhere, but not in the same manner that we have it now. The system of the parole board that we have now, in my opinion, were the people who should be presented with capital punishment. Again, the opportunity to abolish it in Oregon, it would pass 8-1. And there's no question about it. And so I think the people want something to be done. I don't think that that with the state of the Supreme Court, with the North Carolina Supreme Court case presently before the Supreme Court, I think it would be futile to do that this time, or at least we get out of here and nothing really would be done. I think we can do something now. And certainly the bill Senator Brown and I have proposed is not written in stone. There can be lots of modifications in areas, but I think it must be addressed very quickly in this session.
Further questions?
President Brown. It seems that the problem is to identify with accuracy the pathological shelter. And I've heard testimony sometime recently before this committee, or maybe it's before the Human Resources Committee, that the state penitentiary has had until recently only a single psychiatrist and now has a bill for a second. Whether or not the psychiatrist on board is a board-certified psychiatrist, an experienced psychiatrist, one who has had extensive training experience in those skills which would permit him to identify this type of killer. It seems to be our problem is in large measure maybe proper diagnosis.
Well, possibly. Amos tells me that our psychiatrist is a board-certified psychiatrist. I suggest that psychiatric opinion alone is not, forgive me, I have no confidence in it.
I have
no confidence in it because I see courtroom cases where very good and reputable and board-certified, if you will, psychiatrists, each on opposite sides of the same case, both testifying with great confidence, in exactly diametrically opposite directions on it. And so a psychiatrist is bound by his own personal likes, dislikes, whims, and all the things that forge our character. And I think it has to be far broader. The DAs, the judge, the prosecuting attorney, the defense attorney, or a judge, somebody that's got a broader, I'm not dealing with the professional psychiatry, except that I do not like to see them, the judicial would not like to see them, other than an advisory role. Certainly they should be used in an advisory role, and certainly more than one.
Yes, well, that's, I think that's the problem. I wasn't proposing that they only, that they make the decision, but I gather at the present time, or until very recently, you only had one, rather than see a board of three.
I think I would probably rather than budget for that. Would rather, on the occasions when this would be necessary, I would prefer to go out into the private practice of psychiatry and retain them and fill this function rather than perhaps on a full-time basis. Although the case, the strong case can be made for more psychiatric care. In the state penal institution. I'm not sure that a lot of it could not be handled by a competent psychologist rather than a psychiatrist.
Well, as I indicated on the floor of the Senate the other day, I had my run-ins with psychiatrists, and I share that general lack of confidence. Thank you.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Please, Chuck.
In Coy Chuck was here to testify against this bill regarding the mandatory life sentences. I would second Mr. Reed's reflection in regard to this bill. I also recognize that when the human beings are making decisions, there's apt to be mistakes. It would be my suggestion that a reasonable compromise be to what we've been speaking to this morning would be to have a more collective judgment in regards to individuals with life sentences. The parole board has been in existence since 1905, 70 years. History tells us if indeed a person is convicted in the near future for a murder of an individual, this will be the first time in the history of the parole board such an event has occurred. And of course, one time is too many when we're talking about human life. It would be my suggestion that in the cases of these type of people, that we do have a collective judgment exercise, collective judgment in planning for the individual, from officials from not only the parole board, but also the corrections division and perhaps judicial area. As far as management of people are concerned, within an institution, people without hope, we can do that. We can keep them locked up in their cells 24 hours a day. But indeed, that's probably what I'd have to do, to keep killing down, taking them hostage, just things of this nature. Once you take away hope from an individual, trouble. I think we can look at Devil's Island, I think we can look at the Alcatraz situation, and I think we can look to some of our sister states and see how much violence this creates when you take away hope. My 27th year comes up May the 19th in this business. For the most part, we're in fact 99% of the time people are released from institutions. About 1% of the people have been retained. Our longest offenders are in there for over 30 years. So we, in fact, do discriminate. However, we don't have a crystal ball, we don't have a magic wand, we don't always make wise decisions. We're human. So perhaps with our present knowledge, excluding psychologists and psychiatrists who, my opinion, have no better judgment than we do in evaluating these people, but with our collective judgment, I think, working together, and I think this is long overdue, I think we can come to proper decisions in individual cases which will protect society, and hopefully we'll never have a repeat of such a case.
Question. Would you agree that there are certain persons in our state of knowledge that should never be released?
With our present day knowledge, yes.
Don't you think the judge could play a useful role in this decision making? He, after all, hears all of the details of the crime and how it was committed. This information, I would suppose, is not available to you. You don't get a transcript of every trial to read it.
In some cases, we do, and we certainly get pre-sentence investigations and things of this nature. But I think it takes a collective judgment because people can change and do change. You know, I'll run the institution in the way the law dictates. Mr. Bowe did testify, President Bowe did testify that we recently had a study conducted as far as recidivism rate. And it is quite positive at this point. But I think we can negate that by creating a situation where you have men without hope, which would not allow me to run the programs where we have an operation now.
There are answers to that. You could contract for services from other units of government to take those people. That wouldn't necessarily be your problem.
The last three people I attempted to transfer, they would not take because they are overcrowded. I'm talking about the California system, the federal system. It's not always that easy to move an individual. And I'm afraid what we'd be doing was be transferring one management problem to another institution, creating a management situation for them.
Yeah, there's no doubt they have to have special facilities. Senator Brown.
Mr. Cuff, does one of your psychiatrists have the time to carefully review the transcript of trial in any case which would indicate on at the surface that it involves a pathological type killing? Carefully review.
Our psychiatrist has an opportunity to see him in a pro board psychiatrist both, but again, this is not an exact science.
Does he have the time to carefully review?
Not enough time, certainly. I have about 40 hours for a month of psychiatric time for 1,400 inmates.
First question. How much input do you have to the parole board? When a prisoner comes up for parole, I suppose obviously you submit a report on it.
About 2 years ago was the first time the parole board asked for input. We've been giving input for about the last 2 years.
There's no statutory requirement that you give input?
No.
Does any of your staff sit in at the parole hearing?
No.
And so you give them a written report?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Pauline Anderson.
I represent the ACLU of Oregon as a volunteer lobbyist. The ACLU of Oregon opposes Bill 1014 on the grounds that a this was so well amplified by Mr. Reed, that it violates the Constitution of the State of Oregon, Article 1, Section 15, which reads, "Laws for the punishment of crimes shall be founded on the principles of reformation and not of vindictive justice." Imprisonment without the possibility of parole is, by its very definition, contrary to principles of rehabilitation. Parole can be viewed as a reward for rehabilitation. Its prohibition thus bars or precludes any incentive toward the rehabilitative goal. There is no provision for sentencing review, as Senator Smith's question previously, although this has not been in general favored in Oregon because partly due to the fact that there have not been mandatory sentences before. But the no provision for sentencing review to correct improper exercise of discretion denying parole, to correct improper motives on part of sentencing judge, to allow rehabilitation of offenders by giving them the opportunity of asserting their grievances respect to the sentence, to promote respect for law by ensuring sentencing fairness, etc. Judicial discretion here is standardless. Nothing in the bill sets criteria for determining when parole should be denied. This is unfair to the judiciary. If they exercise natural human instinct and legal constitutional requirements to choose rehabilitation, they are blamed for not choosing parole denial if the defendant sins again. Judges are not technically equipped or specially trained in predicting human behavior or in determining programs of rehabilitation. It is unfair to require them to be burdened with this additional responsibility. Standards such as are provided to the State Board of Parole in ORS 144.175 and 144.180 are necessary to ensure fairness and uniformity of application of judicial discretion. Number four, executive nullification will be demanded in numerous cases. The burden will be placed on the governor to review all no parole sentences imposed. The governor's offices are too busy to do this. They lack the expertise to decide what are very difficult human behavior prediction problems. There are four possibilities open to the governor. A, conscientious efforts to review in depth. B, flat policy of denial in all cases. C, flat policy of granting in all cases. D, haphazard, arbitrary, ad hoc method of handling based on immediate political ramifications. The ACLU is unalterably opposed to any legislation which would impose any mandatory sentence for any crime. Mandatory sentences rarely accomplish the end sought. There are numerous discretionary devices by which the purpose of mandatory sentence can be frustrated, such as the prosecutor's choice of charge, plea discussions, and agreements. Mandatory sentence triggers abuses and distortions of the criminal justice system, such as pleading guilty to the wrong offense to avoid intended result and to obtain more realistic results, where there might be a plea to theft to avoid the robbery conviction, felony murder. Judicial nullification of mandatory sentences can always frustrate mandatory sentencing provisions. If the purpose of such laws is to hamstring judges thought to be soft on criminals, it must be remembered that such laws usually force judges to be even softer than they would like. They are forced to acquit a person of a crime rather than to convict and impose a more realistic sentence. Thus, mandatory sentences corrupt the system. According to the Oregon Bar Association standards relating to sentencing alternatives and procedures, Section 2.1c, the legislature should not specify a mandatory sentence for any sentencing category or for any particular offense. Mandatory sentences based on public clamor and political advantage for community reassurance are an inappropriate response to the clamor. Mandatory sentences fail to discriminate between those who do not need and those who do need custody. It is only some offenders from whom the public needs protection. Not every offender poses future danger to the community. Offenders who do not pose such a danger should not be locked up simply because they committed an offense that is often committed by dangerous people. The appropriate response to the clamor is the development of better probation and parole mechanisms. That, of course, requires money and commitment. The mandatory sentence is the cheap way to proceed. It is politically easier to pass a mandatory sentence law and put the onus on judges to deviate from that law than it is to appropriate the money for sophisticated programs and facilities to rehabilitate offenders.
Question? Thank you very much. Chuck Pfeiffer?
Madam Chairman, my name is Chuck Pfeiffer. I'm a member of the parole board. However, I'm not testifying here speaking necessarily for the parole board. These are my own concepts that I wish to present today. Those of you who heard me testify before the legislature before know that I am not a fence trapper. However, on this particular bill in question, I think that there is a possibility of some high ground rather than going either for or against the bill. Society is demanding a move in the direction of 1014, or at least some type of a tightening of the system. And I think that we had better listen to what society is saying. We have standing in the wings of Senator Bozo after we put up the death penalty, which I can't support, but I think that if we don't tend to our shop a little better, that is going to be imposed on us by demand of the citizens. So I am saying that we do need to tighten up the system. I'm not so sure that 1014 as it is written is necessarily the answer, and I feel that I can kind of say this because when Senator Bo testified, he kind of indicated that the barn door had not been closed as yet on 1014. There are some possibilities that I'd like to touch on that do tighten up the system, and it should be explored before we close the barn door. For example, Senate Bill 53 is up for an amendment, I understand. That's the bill where they are going to have a five-man parole board. One of the matters under discussion in the committee the other day was the possibility that under certain kinds of crimes, such as murder, that it would require the vote of, as I remember, the discussion of all five members of the board. If you've ever worked on a board of five people, that's rather difficult to come by. So I suspect that if such an approach as this would definitely tighten the system. That's one possibility. Mr. Reed suggested a working relationship between the parole board and corrections. And I think that we have to move in this direction, and I think this is very much in order. I do not think it is something that requires a law change, because I cannot support the concept that the people who move in and out of a system should depend upon the decision of the management of that system. I just came from a juvenile system in the state of Oregon where that's so. The superintendent of one of our training schools, either one of them, is the person who has the final responsibility for making the decision who's paroled and who's not. And I'm not real sure that that's as healthy an idea as it might sound. So I hesitate to move in that direction. But I do agree with Amos that I think that the board and corrections have to work much closer together, particularly with these sensitive kinds of cases that we're talking about. But I don't see that necessarily taking a law change to bring about. Another thing that concerns me a little bit is that we're talking about one aspect of a total system. We're dealing with the criminal justice system. And corrections and the parole board are only one part of it. And I am not sure of how much input we have received from law enforcement, from prosecuting attorneys, or from the courts. And I think that it's very essential as we move in this direction that we get input from the total system. Speaking of placing this total responsibility in the hands of the courts, I have a great deal of faith in the courts. I think that Oregon is fortunate in having some splendid judges on the benches. And the parole board, surprisingly enough, have had our ups and downs. We've met with all of them. We've talked with them. I have a lot of faith in them. And yet, as we said on the parole board, we see a tremendous disparity in sentencing as it comes down. For example, in one part of the state, I'd much rather hold up a service station than shoot a cow in that particular part of our state. I think that I would, and I'm not casting stones. I'm just talking about the difference in this big state of Oregon, something that we haven't taken into consideration. Another thing about 1014 that causes me a little concern is it very generally slams the door If, for example, there was a possibility of the sentencing judge out there saying that this person is going to serve his whole life sentence, but after a certain time he would be willing to review, for example, the input from the corrections division and take into consideration the possibility of amending that judgment, then that wouldn't quite close the door. That's another possibility. Another matter that's entered into this whole thing that muddies the water, and I'm not going to get into it too deeply, but if you are aware of the plea bargaining that's going on in our state, this would just muddy the water all to hell, and I'm sure it would make 10-14 very difficult to end up meeting the needs that we're attempting to do. In essence, I guess what I'm trying to say is, by golly, it's about time we move over and take into consideration a little more the welfare and security of our community. But I think that we're going to be in trouble if we slam the door too hard. Having operated correctional institutions, I recognize the deep concerns of Whitecup and Sullivan when they think of having people in their institutions that have absolutely no way out. And I think that is placing dynamite right in their rear pocket. However, I do believe that we are going to have to come up with something, and 10-14 is a move in the direction in which I think we have to move, but I do not think that it is presently written that it's the final answer. Thank you.
Only one statement, Madam Chairman. Maybe in some parts of the state to make your statement than in others.
Right. You notice which side of the mountains I was standing on when I said that.
What input, when you hold a parole hearing, what input do you have from the original sentencing court?
There is a form letter that goes out to the judges prior to the person coming up for parole consideration. Some of the judges see fit to respond in separate cases. Some judges have said, hey, that's up to you. Others give us input constantly. It depends on the individual judges. Some judges say, hey, don't bother me. That's your baby now. But they all have the opportunity for input.
If you get a response from a judge that this person should never be given parole, you consider that?
We certainly do. We don't always agree with them because we have to make our own decision, but it's certainly something that's plugged in and taken into consideration. Because usually these people are coming back, going back to the area from which they were sentenced, and the judge represents our community, and it would be quite foolish if we didn't listen to the feelings of the community with regard to that individual.
What kind of input are you getting from the corrections department in a parole hearing?
We get some excellent input. The report that comes before the board is done by representatives of the corrections division. Part of that input is a recommendation from the unit, and that's the place where the inmate lives. Both institutions, the institutional superintendent himself also gives us their recommendations, and their recommendations, by the way, do not always necessarily agree with the unit team recommendations, which I think is a healthy thing. So we have quite a bit of input.
And this has just come about recently?
Of course, I've only been on the board since September, and it was there when I don't think it used to be that way. I was superintendent at OSPI about 8 years ago, and at that time we had very little input into what the full board did, so it has changed.
Would more input be helpful?
Yes, I think it's more than input that we need. I think that we've got to, sometimes parole and corrections forget that we're in the same boat. And we throw rocks at the other guy's boat, and you know we're knocking holes in the same one. I think we've got to work closer together. And I think we all agree to that. There is no disagreement that we have to work closer together. And we're moving in that direction.
Well, if it went from 1905 up to present, and you, or to recent times, and you didn't work together, I wonder why it took that many years to find this out.
Well,
you on the board and don't have the answer to it.
Well, the full-time board has only been in existence, what, 4 or 5 years, something like that. And I think that since the advent of the full-time board is when we begin moving in the direction of working together. previously it was an entirely independent kind of operation. It was citizens that came in on a part-time basis, and it would have been difficult to bring this about.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tom Jones.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Jones, a member of the parole board. I come before the committee this morning not to necessarily speak firmly in opposition to this legislation, but I think that there are some additional points that should have significance in the consideration of what might be equity in terms of people incarcerated in the institutions. Now, while the concern that's manifest in the wording of the bill certainly has justification, I feel that to some extent it might represent an overreaction stimulated by unfortunate occurrences of recent vintage. By the same token, I am cognizant of the fact that the people of the state of Oregon have a right to register a great concern about the personal safety of this society. But one of the unfortunate byproducts of overreaction sometimes develops situations where the baby is very unfortunately tossed out with the bathwater. Now let me amplify that just a bit. There's a gross concern in the legislation for the crime of murder. And I would be the first to admit that murder is the most reprehensible act.
Yeah.
But I know that the bill does not extend itself to other areas just as disastrous to the society. And this brings into play my concern then about the equity as it pertains to people and institutions. I would like to talk for a minute about, let's say, the rapist, who in an overall comprehensive look possibly is a much greater cancer on this society. And I think that the inequity that exists there would soon be obvious should this legislation be put into practice. I think, as a member of the board, when I read the case history on rapists who have committed that heinous crime, in some cases more than once, and has not totally dispatched the victim, and then we have two people who are living with a kind of blight on them for the rest of their lives. I certainly see the need for a more sophisticated process in dealing with the, quote, heavy. I think this process can be brought into being. I suspect that it is going to take some intensive soul searching in terms of just how confident do we want to become in the area of dispensing justice. And I think that comprehensive look has to go all the way back to the beginning of the process that sends a person to an institution. I think we have to be concerned whether the defendant is in all cases properly defended by sufficient and competent legal counsel. I think we have to be concerned whether the judge has all of the support mechanisms mandatory for him to make the proper decision relative to whether an individual shall be committed to the Corrections Division for life. I think we have to be concerned also about the Corrections Division and to determine whether we are willing to make the commitment in dollars and personnel to properly manage the situation that certainly will occur. I think we have to look at the fact that ultimately we will have to build possibly a new maximum security institution and then sort of place this category of individual in that institution and in a most indirect way say, now you are free to kill each other just so long as you are not able to become a part again of the total society. Now again, I hasten to say that there is justification for the posture taken by the committee. I think if you have the opportunity to read in detail or look at pictures of the kind of heinous crimes that are committed, that is the lot of the parole board, you, like me, would develop very mixed emotions. My moral standing sometimes puts me in a category of totally supporting the concepts of this legislation. But then, in more saner, calmer moods, I again have to reflect that the mandates of the legislation are inequitable. I would trust that the wisdom of the committee would move cautiously in this area, not be fit totally, but to also consider that there are other serious areas that need to be addressed as it pertains to people incarcerated in our state institutions that have equal impact. And that if we are going to be able to proceed through the years calm in the feeling that we have been as equitable as possible in dealing with the circumstance, then I think this kind of approach is mandatory. Thank you very much.
Question. Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. You have it, Burns.
Citizen of Oregon, formerly an inmate of the Oregon State Penitentiary, and as well as
state your name, please,
Robert L. Burns.
Thank you.
I served time in the Oregon State Penitentiary as well as the California system. I was convicted in California of a crime of felony murder on a police officer, being an accomplice there too. The judge had three ways to go in my case. He could have imposed the death penalty, which he chose not to do. He could have imposed life without possibility of parole, or he could have did what he finally done. He placed in the record a stipulation that I should never be released on his recommendation unless there was a complete change of personality. I believe that this stipulation was the one thing that gave me the hope to better myself, to change my personality, and to eventually work my way out of the institution and to become a useful citizen. I'd like to take you back and give you a little bit of the insight of what I've lived through in Folsom Prison. They have a place there called the screen area, maximum security. The institutional officers have no choice but to create a prison within a prison. They had 150 maximum security prisoners there, and most of them doing life without possibility. It was just exactly like walking among a bunch of reptiles. These men were back to the wall. They cared nothing about life, because all they wanted to do was to escape or be left alone. A very good example was a young man who was doing 5 years for burglary, displeased the classification committee one time, and they thought they'd punish him, so they threw him behind the screen on maximum security. He lived 3 days. You step on a man's toe back there, he kills you. Simple as that. These people, myself included at the time, are human beings. They have intelligence. When you leave no possibility for a man to ever work his way out of the system, he puts that intelligence to work. And you'd be surprised at the amount of ingenious escape plans that he can devise. And what has he got to lose? Nothing at all. But as long as there is any hope at all, no matter how slight, that with time and with good conduct, he can convince men that his white cup that he intends to change. And then white cup can take the opportunity to study it, give him encouragement, and work with the other members of the system, such as he did in my case, and gradually work him towards freedom, watching him very closely. I went before the Oregon Parole Board, I think, about 6 times. And each time, I met with Mr. Newell, and Mr. Newell's not a soft man. Each time, we had quite a head knocking. Finally, he was convinced that my personality had changed, and he recommended parole. The situation was complicated, of course, by the California detainer and so forth. Finally, the governor of the state of Oregon, who's presently in office, granted me sanctuary in the state for the rest of my life. Since then, I have become a useful citizen in the community. I'm a building contractor. I've become married. And I'm proud to be a citizen of Oregon. Thank you.
Question? Are you on parole now?
No, ma'am.
You're off parole. Did anyone ask you to come here today thus far?
My friend David Adams.
Thank you very much. Dave Adams.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Adams. I'm a part of a statewide citizens group that's concerned about how we deal with people in the criminal justice system. I think I'm aware of the problem that the committee has before them. I'm also concerned that the present bill, proposed bill in 1014, we don't believe will accomplish the goal that we need to accomplish. I think we're all aware there are certain individuals that come into our criminal justice system that need more structure than other individuals. Our number one concern is the protection of the community. I'm not sure that if we were to pass Senate Bill 1014 that the community would be adequately protected. The reason for that is that statistically 97% of the people in prison eventually come back into the community, which means the majority of people going into our system will eventually come back. Our concern is that as these people come back, they can either come back with a good attitude towards the community and towards themselves, or they can come back with a very negative, very anti-social attitude, and that also reflects a person's behavior. I became involved with men at OSP in 68 after the riot. In our program, we had quite a number of men that were doing long-term. They were in for life, murder, rape, armed robbery. And the amazing thing is that when men on the inside have an incentive, then people can change. And I think the bill deals, the bill before it, really says that people have no option of being able to change, that people can't change. And the concern is that if we lock a person into this kind of a setup, then we in society have to live with what we produce in that individual. The other concern is that there are certain people that we think need more emotional or psychiatric help, and we feel that can be provided for a man brought in within the institution. And then the institution and the parole board at that point can view that man and say, here's a man that is ready to come out or is not ready to come out. Now, perhaps we need a bill that will deal with those kinds of concepts and that will give the division and the parole board the option of saying this man is or is not prepared to come out. I became involved a few years back with a 16-year-old boy who, in a fit of rage, killed a man. Now, in counseling with that boy over a period of time, it was interesting to see the change in his attitude. When I first met the boy, he was on a hate trip that was unbelievable. Yet, I'm not sure if that boy will be the same person 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Never did. He can change, and then we should allow that person to come back into society. Under the terms of this bill, that person could not come back into society. The other concern, the material that I passed out is a series of articles from the newspaper, editorial. It's interesting, in talking with individuals the last month and a half here, I've not been able to find anyone from the community that logically says this is really the answer of what we should do for these kind of individuals. I think there are times that we have to admit that we just don't know how to deal with certain people. But I think it's very imperative if we throw away the key for all the individuals involved, then in the long run, the people that lose, I think, are the people in our society itself. My concern is that we not overreact at this point. I think we've had the Bowles incident, we've had the Marquette situation. It seems to me much more logical that we take some time, that we study the issue, that we come up with some alternatives to accomplish the goals that we really desire. And then we pass certain bills. But I feel like at the present moment, we try to rush things through at this late date, we may wind up with a bill that will really backfire from the real thing that we desire of it.
What alternatives do you have to suggest?
I think that many of these things could be very well accomplished by the Corrections Division and the Parole Board analyzing individuals in their care and saying, this man is not ready to come out. This man has emotional problems that we can't deal with. Therefore, we will not parole the individual. And I think there should be laws to deal with those kinds of things. I'm not sure the local judge is in the position to make a determination at the time the man commits a crime before the man's going to be 10 years down the pike. So I really feel like the people that deal with people in our correction system could do those kinds of things.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Berlin?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is William Berlin. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon Peace Officers Association. Here is the court, 10-14. We've reviewed this bill very carefully, and we feel that on section 4, subs 1, 2, and 3 on page 3, gives ample opportunity for the court who is hearing the matter in its original jurisdiction to make a fair and determining judgment based on all the information available to it. It has access, as we interpret this bill, the state has the opportunity to present information, the defendant has the opportunity to present information, and as many other persons as the court deems necessary, as we read these sections, may be called before the court prior to the time the judge makes his decision as to whether or not the defendant should be placed in custody for life without the possibility of parole. For the sake of brevity, that's our testimony and our position. Answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Mr. Gonzalez?
My name is John Gonzalez. My address is 4380 Batty Street, Northeast. And I'm employed to Art Reese, and I'm here on all behalf. And I'm opposing Bill 1014 because I feel in my own conscience, as an ex-offender myself, man without hope, just better off dead. And I was in the Oregon State Penitentiary when the changes started to take place, when Mr. Cutts started to change things around. And I'm not here, and nobody's encouraged me to come here. I came here on my own will to tell you that the changes that have taken place in the last 4 years have been for the better, far more for the better than they have for the worse. I know there's been some mistakes in judgment, but I say that there was a man discussed it a while ago that has been in the Oregon State Penitentiary 32 years. I say that if the efforts that have been put in into the Oregon State Penitentiary in the process of changing were taking place some 15 or 20 years ago, perhaps that man could be out here on the street. He doesn't know how to cope with reality. He's scared to death. Security is those four walls for him. He has not become involved. He's afraid to become involved. Nobody has ever, in the past, had extended their hand to such a degree as it has been extended in the past 4 or 5 years. That's my testimony.
Listen, thank you very much for coming. Mr. Jamal, did you have anything to say? That concludes the hearing and meeting of the
Senate Committee on Judiciary. Wednesday, May 21st, 1975, 8 a.m. from 407A. Work session on Senate Bill 822 and 835, B. Engross House Bill 2579, Senate Bill 827, 975, and 1013, A. Engross House Bill 2047, B. Engross House Bill 2068, B. Engross House Bill 2227, A. Engross House Bill 2335, 2336, 2645, and Senate Bill 80.
2227. I know how to spell 2227.
Did you get the cigarette box, or do you want some of these? John, are there amendments to 2227?
No, Madam Chairman. The bill, as it came from the House Committee, is simply creates a general statute of limitations with regard to contesting the validity of the establishment or the altering of boundaries of governmental subdivisions. Evidently, in the past, it's been necessary to come to each legislative session and have a validating act enacted. And this particular section 2 is simply alleviate that continual approaching of the legislature, which have a general statute of limitations applying to each of those boundary establishments or alterations listed there from lines 13 through 32. The limitation is a year period.
Is this all districts or just school districts?
No, it applies to city-county consolidations under City-County Consolidation Act of 1971. City consolidations, incorporations, annexations, rules, and mergers, formation and changes in people's utility districts, school districts.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I move it out due pass.
Motion is to move the bill out due pass. Extension.
John, the limitation now is what?
It's a 1 year period of limitation.
It currently is 1 year.
No, excuse me. The period now is not standard or uniform at all. It varies.
From what to what?
I think he indicated, I think from about 3 months to several years. this would make it uniform in 1 year, but it's not uniform now with these various.
The opposition.
I have not had any.
We haven't had any, no.
Let's call roll on Bill.
Jim Brown?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Manson?
Aye. 10-13. That's a Senate bill. That's Ted's bill after 10 years that parties should make an effort to be self-supporting.
How do you determine that?
Any motions on the bill?
Sort of a mens lib bill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does it require a hearing before the court? It requires that the parties go back into court and the court determines.
Yes.
Is that right?
John, does it need any amendment?
No, it doesn't matter.
I'll move it too slowly to pass.
Let me read it.
I think everybody should try to be self-supporting. Support your P&O.
Particularly if you've been divorced for 10 years. You ready, Glenn?
Part of my philosophy is just conservation of human and natural resources. First you have one.
Now, first question is, would this apply to a property settlement in the form of payments over a period of time? There's a distinction between payment of money as a part of a property settlement arrangement and one that's just pure alimony.
Support and maintenance.
And, of course, if for Section 2, and I haven't read Section 3 yet, but for Section 2 to have any meaning, it seems to me that it must apply to the lump sum type thing, because the court currently has jurisdiction to modify alimony and pure alimony. You can modify it 1 year or 3 years.
That's still a change of circumstance.
That's still a change of circumstance, yeah. Or, I suppose, here's the point here, we're providing an additional basis here of...
This one shows no change of circumstance.
Right.
This is simply
said that
the
person that sits there
for 10 years
can
be terminated.
Good
call,
Bill.
Debbie
Dale? Aye.
Cook?
I abstain.
Robert?
Aye.
Yes?
Aye.
Nancy? Aye. This is in Senate Hallett, that's carried to go.
This will be an Oregon first.
I'll talk about it. I think you got it.
822.
Mr. Chairman, here are amendments that replace the bill that you have that's been
over.
And this is by the sponsor?
Yes.
The total replacement? Yes, it is. I'm pretty sure the Senator Gerns said concurs in the amount.
Yes, he does. You want to explain him, John?
Yes, Madam Chairman. What it does is basically provide for a civil penalty, a minimum statutory civil penalty to attach if a merchant brings an action against somebody who has shoplifted or attempted shoplift from their store, and that in addition to the minimum civil penalty of not less than $100 nor more than $250, it would provide for mandatory award of costs and disbursements and reasonable attorney fees.
Does it provide for different defendants attorney fees in the event the defendant prevails?
I don't believe that it does, no. No, it doesn't.
So it moves that it be amended to provide for defendant process persons and attorney fees if the defendant prevails.
Sure. Let's talk about that a minute. My question is that it's limited to $250 with a minimum of $100.
What's causing this purchase to be
have you finished that?
No, we haven't.
That discussion of that plan?
No, I made a motion.
I'd just like to argue that point for a moment.
Well, if they are taken to court and the defendant prevails, then it's only fair that they get their attorney fees as well.
If anybody gets attorney fees, they ought to be available either way.
Further discussion on the motion. Let's call the roll.
Aye. Cook.
Aye.
Robert.
Aye. We're just going to put in here for the prevailing party.
I don't know.
Madam Chairman.
Aye.
Let me ask, I'm going to ask the inspector if it's a very radical change from the original bill, isn't it? I mean, the original bill was deals with a whole lot of other things. So this really is getting at it. Is this a civil penalty in addition or alternative? That's what I'm not sure of. Is it in addition to the present criminal penalties for shoplifting?
Yeah.
Is it optional? Is there a way? What is this, a diversion? Or how do you decide?
No, it would be a matter of assuming that the facts were present to bring a criminal action. That would be one course that the merchant might pursue. The other course would be to bring an action for damages suffered, civil damages suffered by the merchant. And if he does that and he prevails, he's going to get this penalty provision of at least $100 and not more than $250 plus attorney fees and costs in addition to damages. So it's strictly a civil remedy.
Madam Chair, I don't view this as in any way a departure from the original bill, except just a simplification and clarification. It's the same basic concept of civil liability for a trespass.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
John, I recall the original bill had language in it to allow the merchant to detain for reasonable cause an individual thought to have committed this kind of crime. There's no language in this revised bill that would relieve him from liability should he detain one for reasonable cause inside the store.
Not in this bill. However, the bill as it was originally printed repealed an existing statute which sets out the standards that a merchant must abide by when he detains and interrogates somebody in a store. He's got to have probable cause to believe that theft has been committed or is being committed. He also has to exercise reasonableness in any detention or interrogation that he conducts. That's reasonableness in time and manner, right? So there is still that. The bill as it was originally printed was lowering the standards to which a merchant would have to comply in detaining and interrogating someone
within the store.
Yeah.
A different set of principles apply outside the store.
No, No, not really. It would be the same thing.
It's in the parking lot or on the property.
Mr. Wilson, Senator Dernstedt agrees with your...
Senator Dernstedt concurs in the amendments that we propose.
Is there any motion to adopt the amendments presented to it?
I want to ask one question. What's this ORS 164045 and 055?
The statute stating the substantive crimes of theft in the first and second degree.
I'll move to adopt the amendments with one exception. The word offender, six lines from the bottom, bothers me in essentially a civil provision. I'm not quite sure what we want to substitute there. It's a first-time shoplifter.
I think that is unclear as to whether or not they mean offender under this particular civil remedy, or whether they mean offender from the standpoint of a criminal conviction.
Yes, Wilson, do you have a suggested change?
I don't have a word right off the top of my head, but I understand what Senator Brown means.
We're talking about civil offense here.
Yes.
I use the word offense. Civil wrong.
First occurrence?
Senator
Brown.
You know, we had, when we were considering Walt's bill on the liability of parents on most things, we had testimony from Tom Destinette that the kinds of acts contemplated there, at least, would be covered by the homeowner's insurance policy, which is generally available. Now, I would be curious to know whether this... the incidents here would be covered by the homeowner's insurance policy.
I would think it would, but I know Tom's not here.
I wonder if we could wait to vote it out. My feeling is if there's a way you can insure against the risk that one of your kids will steal something, I guess that's what it amounts to, and then you end up... That's for a civil penalty, and I don't know how much attorney's fees, it could be quite a bit. I think that's one thing. On the other hand, I think it's another thing that you're really exposing a parent to something that's a little bit harder to justify if you can't insure against the risk. And I wonder, that's my concern with this part of making the parents liable.
Can you answer that question?
Sort of tainting of blood.
Tainting what?
Of blood.
Blood.
Right. Constitution says pass on the crime to a family.
There can be
no tainting of blood.
So that's what you're saying. A tainting of blood, yeah. Reverse.
Right.
Yeah.
Senator Brown has moved the presented amendment. With the suggestion that the word offender be changed to something
other. Civil.
Well, we can amend, after we adopt this, then we can amend the bill as amended.
Right.
But that's
true. Right. These amendments are before us as amended already. First call roll on the amendment.
Aye.
Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Here?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye.
Now, I wonder, Madam Chairman, if we could get Tom or someone equally authoritative here before we vote on sending the bill out. Because I am concerned, I think Senator Roberts pointed out, it's a pain of blood. If you can insure against the risk, well, maybe this is a good way of spreading the burden of the juvenile theft. So fine, I think I could probably support it. But on the other hand, if it's not an insurable risk under any existing policy as far as the parent is concerned, then I'm really concerned about this part, making the parents or legal guardians or either parents or legal guardians, it could be anybody, responsible for the thievery of their kids.
In the box.
We already have two current existing provisions in the ORS which comparable liability on the parents, the $300 limit for general vandalism and the $1,000 limit for
vandalism by a school
that's
student.
Vandalism.
Whether you're stealing the item or destroying the item is a novel distinction to me. I think the principle has been established that parents have some civil liability. And the question is the degree.
Well, that's been my concern. Supposedly through the Pine Town, that's right.
But those are covered by insurance, that's what Tom
yeah, they're
said.
Covered by insurance. All those things I think that you referred to, according to Tom, when we testified on your bill, are covered by the homeowner's policy.
What would you like to do, send this message?
I'd like to pass the bill out.
I don't think you have the vote.
Well, ask me another question.
Send this message, move the bill out, just that, as amended. Discussion. Let's call the roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Cook?
No.
Robert?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
No.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to see the bill go to the floor, and I don't want to hold it up. And I did complain about weakening the provisions of the belief, the time, and the manner that guidance, and that's been all deleted, and therefore I'm much happier with the bill.
Madam Chairman,
like
we want to act on it now. I would move that the amended bill be amended so as to delete all of Section 2 except the sentence, the court may waive the minimum damages specified in this subsection where the court finds that the minor child is a first offender. In other words, the purpose of mine not knowing what the insurability situation is, I would want to delete the part imposing liability upon the parent or legal guardian. The rest of it is I could support it. That out. Now, if I could support it with that in, if we found that we were assured that the homeowner's policy was fine.
All right, you've made your motion. Discussion of the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Cindy Brown?
No.
Cook?
Aye.
Robert?
No.
Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion failed. Senate Bill
835.
John, you
want to
address this?
I'll be right back. Madam Chairman, this bill on Section 2 is a section that this committee has already amended as far as setting various limits on personal and real property in Senate Bill 835.
Did you say there are amendments?
Well, I'm just saying that, first of all, Section 2 is a section that this committee has already dealt with in another bill dealing with the upper limits of real and personal property and which comes under the Small Estates Act. Section 1 really has nothing to do with the Small Estates Act. It has to do with estates which are probated or there's an administrator appointed in them, and it broadens the power of the probate commissioner in handling those estates so that he can take care of them now and act upon them, and it applies to any estate which is of the value of $12,500 or less. The use of the term small estate is a little bit deceptive. As I say, it has nothing to do with the Small Estates Act. It has to do with estates that are do go to probate or administration, and it simply broadens the power of the probate commissioner to deal with that type of estate. We do have a letter in your packet from Mr. Stan Allison. I believe he's representing the Oregon State Bar. comment upon the bill.
What are his comments in summary?
Well, first of all, he helped this committee in amending what is Section 2 in this particular bill, and his comment is that he thought that those amendments that were adequate and does not give his support to the amendments in this bill. So far as Section 1 goes, I don't think that he really reaches an opinion as to whether or not he thinks it's desirable. He thinks the bill is confusing, but he doesn't really state one way or another.
Are there any motions on the bill? Let's turn to Senate Bill 271. Are there amendments to 271, Your Honor?
Yes, Madam Chairman, they should be in your packet.
I don't have any.
It should be
in the back, the very back.
One page. That is okay. The proposed amendment. If you look at the A. and Gross bill, what these amendments do for the most part is restore material that is deleted by the bill. The first amendment on page 2 is correcting what seems to be a printer's error in stating the existing law. So that's really no substantive change. The portions that are restored start out on page 3. If you look at lines 8 and 9, there's a restoration of the sentence, "The matters pertinent to the findings include." That particular sentence, as well as paragraphs capital A, B, C, and D, which are also restored, are part of Federal Rule 23, and it's simply putting those back in. On line 17 of page 3, the phrase "including the feasibility of giving adequate notice" is still deleted. That's the provision that is in the Oregon law that is not in Federal Rule 23. Subparagraph E is still deleted. That's not in Federal Rule 23, and it does tend to defeat the purpose of the class action. Paragraph F is restored. This would allow a court a little bit more flexibility in handling a class action case. In line 30, in line 33, you also have a restoration of a sentence. "An order under this section may be," going over on page 4, conditional, and a restoration of the remainder of that sentence. That is a provision that is in Federal Rule 23, and it is, I think, desirable to give the court that flexibility. I spoke with Mr. Perry about these changes, and he concurred with them. It was said that his intent was not to delete matters that are in Federal Rule 23 as it now stands.
What's the source of these amendments, then?
I'm the source. Yes. Thanks. I did check with, Henry Perry about them, mainly because they seem to me to be of assistance to the court, and they didn't seem to go against the intent of Mr. Carey, and he said that his intent was to take Federal Rule 23 as much as he could, and that's what this would do. It would put portions back in.
Is there a motion on amendments?
I mean,
then the clerk moves the amendments. Is there any objection to the amendments? Amendments are adopted. Is there a motion on the bill?
Move it out, move that.
And the clerk moves Senate Bill 271 out, you pass as amended. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Jimmy Brown?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. 45.
Excuse me, this bill provides, first of all, that the State Board of Parole, within 6 months after a person is convicted of a crime and sent to the state penal or correctional institution, the State Board of Parole, within that time, must review any information which they have about that person. In addition to that, it requires that each convicted person be personally interviewed every 2 years. It does not necessarily have to be a parole hearing. However, a parole hearing could fulfill this requirement of a personal interview. There's a subsection 3 of section 2 allows for a waiver of the requirement of a personal interview by the convicted person. And subsection 4 defines convicted person as to what that term means. Someone who is sentenced to a term of imprisonment for more than 3 years. Section 3 applies the provisions of Section 2 to people who have been convicted before the effective date of this act. And I believe that the sentences on page 3 attempt to deal with the situation where the parole board already has told somebody that you won't be coming back up before us for another 3 years, it's simply to say that that is void for the purposes of the requirement of having a personal interview every 2 years. I think that if the committee acts on the bill, you ought to put a sub 2 up on line 1, page 3, simply making that a subsection of section 3.
In the attitude of the people involved. Bill Hitchcock?
Yeah, he justified in favor of this. And then there's one other factor, the bill increasing the parole board to 5 members has passed both houses.
Well, would that mean, Madam Chairman, that the requirements of this proposal could be fulfilled by one member of the parole board having an interview with the person?
Sounds that way, is that right?
As I would read it, I would think it would be the board. Perhaps it could be a matter of they're sitting in panel, but it doesn't really read as though it could be delegated to one person.
How about
the language of the State Board of Parole?
What if we, would it be hard to amend it? So that we could say it must be by the State Board of Parole or a member designated by the board? I would move that. I think that's more practical.
Will you repeat it, please?
In substance, it would be the interview could be conducted by the parole board or a member of the parole board designated by the board. I think it should be, that gives us a formality, it's like a substance. And that would fit into the 5. Now they have more time. One or more designated by the board. See, that's my amendment.
Is there any objection to Senator Cook's amendment? The amendment is adopted. Included in Senator Cook's amendment was that line 1 on page 3 have a subsection 2 put into it.
I move it out to the pass.
Senator Cook moves A and Gross House Bill 2645 out to pass as amended. Discussion? Clerk, call roll.
Aye.
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 Madam Chairman, what has happened to our bill that we voted out of here to prohibit discrimination against people over 65?
John is just swamped. He's trying to get the amendments done, and he's...
I should get that before you end the call.
Now, we have 3 bills relating to the...
Is that all about?
We have 3 bills.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. Which bill do you want to take up there? She wants to take it.
Hey, could we all get together now? We have 3 bills. We have dealing with criminal records. We have 2579, which is the bill that came from the House with the majority report and the minority report. And for those who weren't here, we did have extensive. John, you want to give a 1 minute summary of 2579?
First of all, it deals primarily with what is defined as criminal records, which are public records. We're mainly talking about court orders or the actual, say, an arrest, which is a public record. It deals also what is defined as criminal with criminal investigation material, which would be your typical police crime report, something like that. But its primary thrust has to do with criminal records. The chief distinction between the majority and the minority report is that the majority report makes these things defined as criminal records.
Compilations.
Which are compilations of public records, confidential, whereas the minority report does not deal with them or does not expressly say that they will be confidential. Section 2 of the majority report and Section 3 really contain the differences between the minority and majority report. Those are the only significant differences between the two reports.
All right, now which one was finally adopted in the House?
The majority report expressly saying that criminal records are or shall be confidential, and they it limits those persons with whom these records can be made available.
Now, we had talked with Mr. Trelat about drawing extensive amendments to this bill. And as I was saying, we have a choice between three bills here, or maybe passing one or more of them would be compatible. 827 is Norm Howard's bill, which would relate to expunction of conviction, which is already on the statute. It also relates to, does it relate to expunction of arrest?
Yes, it does.
It relates to, and 975 goes just to expunction of arrest records.
Well, if you passed 975, you wouldn't have jeopardized either of the other two bills, would you? Because it wouldn't be inconsistent with either one of them, would it?
Is that right, John?
Well, Madam Chairman, Section 18 of 2579 does have to do with the sealing of records of arrest.
But 975 could be passed, and we could yet consider the House bill.
Yes, no problem in doing that at all.
Well, I understand 975 fairly well. I'd move it out.
Senator Bailey moves out 975.
Okay, we could delete Section 18.
All right.
Is there any limitation?
One year after finalist.
I'm concerned about limitations in the area of signature crimes and that type of thing.
No, there is not.
Further discussion of the bill.
Now I can hold up a little bit. Well, your handwriting exemplars, if they were in evidence, wouldn't be part of the arrest record.
Well, I'm talking about unique modus operandi. So arrest record's not going to show that.
Might put a both shot.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I think that there should be an amendment to the bill if it's reported out, and that would be to delete what is now subsection 2 of section 3. That exempts matters within the jurisdiction of the juvenile justice system from the application of the bill. However, up in lines 19 through 22 of page 2, they're dealing with records within the juvenile justice system.
The strike lines 33
yeah.
and 34. The chair would move to strike lines 33 and 34 of page 2 of Senate Bill 975. Is there any objection?
change the number on three.
And change the number. Hearing no objection, the amendment is adopted. Attorney Fader, did you move it out?
Yeah.
Is there further discussion?
Yeah, I have.
Attorney Brown.
Mick, you're again, your thoughts on this were.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I don't. I'm not in favor of the destruction. I'm in favor of sealing, and so that it can be available only on court order for good and sufficient cause. And so with that idea, I don't know how it would be done technically, but basically, I'd move in substance that the bill be amended so that these records need not be destroyed.
Senator Cook moves conceptually that the records be sealed and be available to the court upon order, right?
Right.
That'd be in section 2, subsections 2 and 3, you would have to be
probably
amended
that's
then.
Where it would come to pass.
Do you understand the amendment, John?
Yes.
Does anyone object to the amendment? The amendment is adopted. The motion then is to pass Senate Bill 975 out as amended. Discussion? Let's call roll.
Could you Brown?
Aye.
Cook?
Aye.
Fado?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Manager?
Aye. Just back on 975 for a minute. This only applies to where charges have been made but the person has not gone to trial, right?
Right.
Yes,
no, ma'am.
No?
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. It would also apply where it goes to trial and the person is acquitted.
Okay, yeah. All right.
You wouldn't get something on the rap sheet that showed you've been charged with rape, grand larceny, and sexual abuse on the same day and nothing that showed ever what happened to it.
Your bill in 875 provided for the expunction of arrest and conviction, and the law already provides for expunction of conviction, so we passed 975, which provides for expunction of arrest.
Whatever you've done,
I think it takes care of your problem. Thank you. Senate Bill 2047. Senator Fadley, we enjoy your presence, but anytime you have to leave.
What bill is
this? 2047.
Were you planning to vote on sometime this morning? If you did get to Senate Bill 822, I'd be willing to come back up here. I'm not strictly interested in that bill. I just want to
tell you that. You've already gone past it.
Oh, all right. 2047. I thank you. The Ways and Means Committee is still operating, and if you need me again, I might have one more flight up the stairs in there this morning.
Thank you. Are there any amendments to this stuff?
No, Madam Chairman.
Do you want to briefly go over?
Okay.
The present bill or the amended bill?
A
and Gross bill. This bill relates to statutes that have to do with various criminal justice agencies reporting arrests, filing, say, fingerprints, photographs of individuals with the Oregon State Police. A new provision that's added is on page 2, lines 11 through 15. The
defining criminal offender information, and that gives you an idea of what types of information will be flowing to the Oregon State Police. This information does come to them already under their existing practice and the statute, but it's an attempt to define what is going to be coming to them. Step three sets out those instances in which a criminal justice agency is required to forward information to the Oregon State Police. And you're talking about the Bureau of Criminal Identification within the Oregon State Police Department. Over on page 3, lines 8 through 17, does expand the definition of what is currently a criminal justice agency. If you look at paragraph B under 9, courts of criminal jurisdiction, that, although that's not in the existing statute, it probably is, as a matter of practice, is no great change. Sub E, law enforcement agencies, conceivably could apply to out-of-state law enforcement agencies, which isn't in the existing statute. State Board of Parole is not in the existing statute. But again, I would imagine that as a matter of practice, that information flows back and forth to them. And finally, the any state or local agency designated by order of the governor. Disposition report is a new definition, and there is a requirement we get further on into the bill that various disposition reports be made to the Oregon State Police so that their records can be updated and accurate. Section 3 is creating this Bureau of Criminal Identification. It's already in existence. The section is just a restatement of many of the provisions in the portion of the section that's being repealed. It states the duties of the Bureau through the rest of Section 3. Section 5 sets forth the requirements of these various criminal justice agencies to forward fingerprints, photographs, and disposition reports to the Oregon State Police. It also provides that a criminal justice agency, or rather a law enforcement agency, may submit other information than that which is required. That is down in subsection 3 of section 5. Section 6A requires courts to report a final court order in a proceeding to the Oregon State Police. Section 7 provides that this information that does come to the State Police is confidential and exempt from the public record statute. Section 8 requires the Bureau to adopt various rules to implement what authority they have. Section 10 amends the existing statute relating to the expunction of criminal conviction. And what it does is requires that whenever someone seeks to expunge a criminal conviction, that their fingerprints must be filed. And the reason for that is to assure that whatever record is being expunged is connected to the right person. And that really is the main thrust of the amendments made to this existing statute relating to criminal convictions. Over on page 7, lines 8 through 13, makes an exception to the effect of an expunction of a criminal record in instances where you have libel or slander suit. Where you've got truth as an element of the cause of action, then you can apply to the court to get the records that might be expunged under this particular statute.
This would not destroy any records.
No, it wouldn't. This is a ceiling.
I move we send it out and be passed.
Discussion and motion. Clerk, call and roll.
Brown?
Aye.
Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Smith?
There were no amendments. Captain Dougherty testified in favor of it. Mr. Lowry, do you have your amendments?
Senator, I don't have any amendments on it. There were some other amendments that Mr. Winter said I didn't want to ask me about other proposals.
2058. Who submitted these amendments, John?
That one page of amendments was submitted by Bill Peterson, whom I believe is with the Workman's Comp.
Are you able to address the amendment?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Peterson's amendment, a very alternative amendment relating to the standard of evidence in administrative hearing. We have amended in 2068 the existing law on the evidentiary rules in administrative hearing. The existing law says the rules of equity. The amendment as it now stands in existing 2068, was proposed primarily by Professor Hans Lindy, also Representative Frohnmeyer, both of whom were in the field. It is the standard form of evidentiary standard in a number of states, and it works fairly well. The agencies could live with Mr. Peterson's proposed amendments, but I don't think it makes a change other than the change in language.
I don't recall the testimony, but what was the explanation for the utility commissioner's decision going to the circuit court?
Pardon?
What's the reason for the public utility's decision going to the circuit court instead of directly to the circuit court?
This one, this bill takes it away. Mr. Weiser was here.
Did we amend that out?
I don't
because
know.
Because it's not on the summary. It still requires an appeal decision to the...
But that argument would go for every administrative agency, right?
Only PUC is exempt.
Yeah. To be consistent, we'd have to have every single administrative agency decision going to a circuit court so that the court would be available to appeal it.
Well, on the other hand, the argument is to make it consistent, you ought to pass this bill. Then it still eliminates the opportunity for a person who disagrees. The log trucker or any other person doing business with the PUC, he must come to Salem if he has a problem with the PUC order. And I just don't believe we ought to have to do that.
Okay.
Senator Brown.
The provisions that Mr. Weiser directed his attention to were what? I think we start with Section 21, or maybe 27.
21.
A motion on the floor. I move that Section 21 to 29 be deleted.
Senator Brown moves that Sections 21 through 29 be deleted. Discussion.
Well, I object, Madam Chairman. Members will oppose the motion. I think we ought to be consistent in the manner in which the court's operating.
I was impressed by the testimony of the
further discussion and motion. Clerk, call roll.
Sidney Brown?
Aye.
Parsons?
Aye.
Roberts?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Ron Sherman?
Aye.
Madam Chairman, there's one other proposed amendment that has to do with matters on page 17, lines 29 through 31. Keith Skelton submitted an amendment proposing that those lines be deleted.
Page 17, lines what?
Lines 29 through 31.
Page 17, line 7. Beginning where on? What bill are we on?
Page growth 2068. Starting with the language and defects in the content of the notice. Going down through reversal or remand.
Well, there'd be a period after or a semicolon after thereby?
Thereby, yes.
What's the effect of it?
Well, currently, there's no cause for a reversal or remand. If you fail to object to a defect in notice before the commencement of the hearing, if you want to make an objection in a defect in notice after the commencement of the hearing, that's not sufficient grounds for a reversal or remand.
Chair will move the amendment. Discussion. Clerk, call roll.
Sidney Brown?
Aye.
Parsons?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Ron Sherman?
Aye. Any further amendments?
Fill out the
Chairman.
Senator Smith?
On page 17, section 7.
I have a note here, it says see page 11 on that one.
I'd like to explain, possibly it isn't in the last testimony, section 15 and 16 are merely rearrangement. At the present time, 183.480, as it exists, is very difficult for anyone to read because it combines a variety of things. All that I have done here in these sections is to break ORS 183.480 into its component parts and put them into new sections. You will notice that pages 12 through the middle of 15 are all deletions. Therefore, that's preliminary to the answer to the question. Section 7 is the existing law as the basis of review of the contested case of the agencies by the Court of Appeals. The fact that it appears as new law, new language, is it has been merely picked up from a pre-existing section.
Does that answer your question?
I may be too confused. I might also, if I might speak to Representative's proposed amendments on defects in the contents of the notice.
We've already adopted it, please.
No, thank you, President.
One other question, Madam Chairman.
Yeah.
On page 24, we have eliminated the de novo proceeding since the original bill provided that the first appeal was going to the Court of Appeals, and I wonder about the judgment that's doing that. Now we have the Circuit Court involved.
John.
I'm sorry. I'm
well, on page 24, line 70 to 21, we have eliminated de novo proceedings as I read it. And my question is, and the reason that was done, I suppose, is it went up from the Court of Appeal on a record. And I wonder the advisability, since we have the Circuit Court reinstated, that we should not go back to de novo at the Circuit Court level.
I think I can answer that. If you eliminate these sections, the bracketed language will come back into effect because 756-598 will remain as it now stands.
So it's automatically out.
It'll automatically go back. It will read then. I mean, you don't do these. Then you'll leave things as they now stand. So the court review of any findings of fact or conclusion in a Public Utility Commission matter will be conducted by without a jury as a suit in equity, but the court shall not substitute its judgment for that of the commissioner as to any finding of fact supported by substantial evidence. I mean, you really didn't. There wasn't Circuit Court de novo review before, and in this amendment, all this did was sort of clean up that.
Are there further amendments? Senator Walter Brown moved the bill.
Moved the bill out, did pass as amended.
Discussion. Clerk call the roll.
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Roberts?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Ron Simmons?
Aye. Mr. DeWin, are you at a Mr. Barkowski here? Is he here?
Yes.
All right. Would you like to come up and address 2335? Is Mr. Hardy here? And you have a proposed amendment?
I send it to the committee, each member, instead of amendment.
All right, and Mr. Susie, you have a proposed amendment?
I just wanted to explain our position.
All right, would you come up briefly and do so, please? Mr. Hardy, if you want to come up and then briefly explain your position, and then we'll hear from Mr. Susie at the same time.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my amendment to our position relates to Part 5 on page 24, 25. At present time, the grower has a right to a lien which he can move against either the crop produce to be delivered, or the produce that's canned and frozen. And I explained to the committee the last time that nearly every year, clear up into April of the following year, there was always on hand in most of these processing plants an adequate amount of the processed goods for any and all claims of lien, which can be imposed on those processed goods.
Senator Brown.
Is the lien on the particular goods that has come from the farm, or is it a lien as to goods in general in the warehouse?
I think it would be construed by the court as being on, if it's steamed, on canned beans or processed beans.
could have come up with another
They're
product.
Mixed with other beans.
Okay.
So you don't have to. You know that.
Fungible. Right.
Yeah.
Lean
on beans.
The bean lean. Try your own beans.
The difficulties with the amendments that were suggested and are included in A and Gross House Bill 2335 are basically that there has been no demonstrated case that the law of 1973, which provided for the coverage of the processed goods, has been inadequate. There isn't a single case that I know of about that, not even the claim of an inadequacy. But what they have done in this section 53 and in the amendments to 52 and 54 is to take and place, in addition to that rather adequate coverage, that the lien shall be imposed upon the proceeds of the sale of that produce, which, number one, makes it very difficult for the processor to get money from a bank, in which the testimony was in this case that if that passes, the bank would not make those loans. Secondly, it interferes with a system that has been long developed, in which the processor buys in large quantities of the right kind of fertilizer, the right kind of chemicals for the particular food that is being grown, and then advances those items to the grower and deducts that in part from as it accrues. I mean, so that when the payoff comes, a large portion will have of that advance will have been repaid. Now, under the present system, it's working fine. If you do it otherwise, so that they can't even get back their advance, as this would provide, then I think you're going to disrupt a system that has worked well for every processor in the state of Oregon. Now, some people have suggested that they remove the co-op. Well, let me say to you that removing co-ops is not enough. I don't think that by removing co-op, you're going to remove the claim of the non-co-op member, of which there are a great many who ship to co-op who are not co-op members. Or if you do remove co-op totally, then you're going to discriminate between one kind of a shipper and another kind of a shipper, farmer, as to what he sends to whether to a co-op or not to a co-op.
Parties haven't discussed this at length, as I understand it, and they're not able to agree. Mr. Fuji, would you like to address?
Yes, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we appreciate the opportunity to make our comments on this section 53 and 54. Now, after the bill passed last session, a number of questions started coming back to us on. Number one, one of the questions was, how about the time element? A lot of these contracts are set up for settlement 30 days after delivery. Then then the time that a producer might implement this loan would be the 10th day after that, which would be 40 days after he delivered. This is one of the problems. Then another question was asked as to what happens, like happened in the one of the cases of the firms that went out of business here a number of years ago, where the produce came in the door in the morning, and either that later that day or the next day it went out the back door, and within that 40 day time it could be made into jam or whatever and be consumed. Then what? So the going back to the basic principle of the idea of this law, that we protect the producer's interest in the price that he had agreed to sell the product for, or the fair market value if there was no agreement on price. We feel that this should extend to the proceeds of the lien, similar to the manner in which the labor lien law covers, in which the proceeds of sale are also subject to a labor lien, because in the case of agriculture products for processing, if the product didn't come through the front door, or through the delivery door. Nothing happened in there. And it seems to me that the financial agency, where the lien would only be for the value of the raw product, that they, if they accept the reference to, as to the lien on the produce if it's there, why, it doesn't seem to me that it would make any difference if the same value in the draft that came in for the payment of the produce when it was sold, it should not also belong to the grower. This is a basic principle as to protecting the producer's interest in a product that he has sold for conversion into another form for sale.
Any questions for the party?
Because in the closure of the two plants here several years ago, why, a number of the farmers lost, it's estimated, over $500,000 in the two plants. And I know Mr. Hardy's statement is true, that since last session there has been no demonstration of need. But maybe this is a case of closing the barn door after the horse is gone. But we may have some colts in the barn later on that we want to hold in there.
What's your objection with section 54? Mr. Hardy. What's your objection to section 54? What specific language?
Well, just the only objection I have to it is the 10th day after the date.
Deletion of that.
The 10th day after.
The deletion of that.
Okay.
The same thing applies in, is a deletion in subsection B of section 2 of 53 at the top of page 25.
Madam Chairman, I'd also like to say that I did come to an agreement with the processors committee prior to the last hearing, and the amendments that I furnished the committee at that time are still valid. It would delete the new language in line 33 and 34, and also provide an exemption to section 53 for cooperatives and cooperative pooling arrangements that in which the all people share in the proceeds according to their participation, because there are these cooperative pooling arrangements in which not only growers but packers and other people are involved sometime in years of surplus when they pool the entire crop so that they can have a chance to marketed on an orderly basis.
Thank you, Mr. Cruzzi. Are there any motions?
I'm not prepared to vote on to this until I have time more starting to study it.
No motions for amendments, any motions on the bill? Hearing no motions, we'll turn to 2336. Does anybody want Mr. Barkowski to give a 2-minute review of this?
What number?
2336.
We
can delete the same thing. We know they are.
We have had no objection to this bill. Does anybody want Ms. Barkowski to review it again?
You say there's no amendments to the bill?
We have no amendments, no objections.
I'd move the bill before you can.
Ken Roberts, move the bill out. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Pardon?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Let's take a look at 2579. Is Nick Gillette still here? Well, while they're looking for Nick Gillette, 133 is a victims of crime bill that has a prior referral to Ways and Means. We already sent another victims of crime. This one could be tabled.
So moved.
Move table 133. Clerk, call and roll.
Hi.
That's right. Let's try again.
Hi.
Hi. We can table 704. It's a juvenile bill of confidentiality, and it was covered by 675.
I'll move the table.
704, table. Put call and roll.
Hi.
Okay.
Hi. Hi.
712 can also be tabled. It's a juvenile rights to an attorney, which was covered by 675.
Moved.
Call roll.
Carson?
Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Smith? Aye.
Aye. Okay, let's look at 2579. Mr.
Chairman.
Did I tell you a different time on this?
No, ma'am.
Are you ready?
No. Yes, we are. By we, I mean Mr. Lowry and I. Since I was also working on 1014, I asked Al to prepare a
2579
amendment consistent with the discussions that I had with certain members of the committee.
2335.
The amendments, by the way, are mislabeled. I think they say 2597. It should be 2579. The approach that I wanted to take with this, it seemed to me that a principal thrust of the concern between the majority and the minority report, which were argued about in the House and which got settled on a close vote, was a particular concern that there be some misuse of criminal justice information with respect to hiring and firing or with respect to licensing. Now, inquiring about prior criminal history with respect to licensing, except where there's some kind of rational connection, is really already illegal, but nobody knows about the law. You passed that one last session. It's lying there, hidden away, and the agencies persist in asking the questions anyway. It's just something we've got to educate people on. But there was offered in the Senate Committee on Consumer and Business Affairs a bill which would have sponsored by the chairman, which would have made it illegal to inquire about convictions, and it seemed to me that by expanding upon that concept, it was possible to amend 2579 to take care of the worst of the concerns, at least those who were concerned about what was being done with the criminal record as opposed to criminal investigatory information, which is discussed in 2579. Mm-hmm. Mr. Lally has prepared amendments which we hope accomplish the purpose we had in mind, and the purpose we had in mind was this. It ought not to be permissible for an employer, either public or private, to make an inquiry with respect to a person's prior contact with the criminal justice system unless the inquiry is related in a direct and rational way to the position for which the person is applying for a job. This includes not just conviction, but arrest. It includes both because sometimes an arrest, even though not followed by a conviction, bears so closely upon the kind of job that you're discussing, that it's the kind of information an employer reasonably ought to be entitled to. And so Mr. Lowry's amendments are drawn with that in mind, but he drew them, I didn't, and I haven't even had a chance to read them. So after explaining the process we went through, I'll leave it to him to explain the amendments.
Chairman, question. And given that, you have further provided that the criminal record may be file and a public record.
Yes. So if essentially it would represent an adoption of the minority view, the minority report, with respect to the criminal record, if I got the right label, the criminal record, it would remain permanently a public record.
Could not be used again.
That could not be used, and in fact was even provided it for an employer to obtain it, the prima facie unlawful employment practice. Unless he's been able to demonstrate the rational nexus between the inquiry and so on. Mr. Lowry can speak to the amendments in more detail, but that was the concept that I had in mind that I wanted to offer to the committee as an alternative to the present bill takes.
Which well,
I think
it's,
that's a
it's a substantial change.
Very.
Stevie, did you just get the amendments today? I think we'd have to allow more time unless anybody wants to make a motion on the bill as it stands.
Oh, I'd like to hear the explanation.
Basically, what I have done, the proposed amendments to MRB and growth HB 2597, that's the minority report, which has been in growth. Now, what was passed by the House was majority B in growth, House Bill 2579. The difference between the two of them is, as was stated here earlier, one core thing. Does that compilation of public records related to a specific individual, is that continue to be public record? Is that access to anybody who wants it, which is the minority report? Or is it only available to criminal justice agency and under other circumstances, which is the majority report and the bill as it came up from the House? In order to accomplish what Mick is talking about, would be to go back to the minority report. That can be done mechanically. I did not do amendments all over again because John and I could work that out mechanically. You do have the House Minority Report amendments to A. and Gross House Bill 2579. What we would propose is the adoption of a minority report form that does not make confidential matters of the compilation the criminal record, that is, the compilation of matters of public record. Eliminate there from Section 18, which provides for the sealing of an arrest record. And in lieu thereof, this is where the amendments come in, amend the present, put in a new section which says that an employer cannot ask for criminal records in an employment application. He can't refuse to hire employer bar discharged from employment solely because of a criminal record, and provides that a complaint may be filed with the commissioner of labor. This would go into the civil rights section of the Department of Labor, and that it would be prima facie violation if an employer asked for a criminal record. In order to avoid the fiscal impact on the amendment, subsection 4, there's a subsequent to July 1, 1977. No employer or employment agency shall use any form of application for employment or make any inquiry in connection with prospective employment which has not been adopted or approved by the Bureau. In other words, the Bureau of Labor would make the determination of what you ask for. If somebody has a particularly sensitive job, the Bureau of Labor, which has a particular area that a criminal record information needs to be, would approve the Bureau of Labor that inquiry should be made. Section 20, the balance of the sections are merely conformity of existing SB 860, and 860 was before Consumer Protection, which was a bill that included in the unfair employment practices the basis of a criminal conviction. Instead of criminal conviction, we would add criminal record as defined by this act, so that would cover both convictions and records of arrest, making it an unfair employment.
Madam Chairman, let me ask you a ridiculous question. I'm an employer, and I have a restaurant. If I ask a proposed employee, have you had any convictions in the past? Because I'm worried about he or she stealing from my restaurant. If if he or she says no, I have not. It is prima facie evidence that I have broken the amendment. If she says yes, I have no idea. If she says, or he says yes, and I have been convicted of sodomy, which has nothing probably to do with her ability, his or her ability to proceed as an employee of a restaurant, then I have still broken the prima facie cause of this amendment. But if he or she says, I have been convicted of burglary, then I have not broken the law, but I will not have known unless I ask, and if I do not receive the right question, I'm in trouble.
Well, let me see if I can follow through your hypothetical. Don't ask anything at all, you're fine. If you ask if you've been convicted, prima facie, you're guilty of the unfair employment practice. If they say no and you don't hire them, you say I didn't hire them for some other reason. If they say yes, I've been convicted of sodomy, and you don't hire them, then you probably would have committed an unfair employment practice. If sodomy doesn't have anything to do with waiting on tables or handling a till, is what you're basically talking about. Yes, I have been convicted of larceny, and you don't hire them. You probably wouldn't be, I would say, in that it wouldn't be a determination that you're guilty of an unfair employment practice because it is job related. No, I recognize it. Okay.
I have my answer.
Some of those questions depend on what kind of place you're running, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'd like to get an idea of the committee. I think we have. Sam, did you want to say anything?
Well, if I could comment very
briefly.
You
have just seen the amendments, I suppose.
And Mr. Lesson explained to me briefly before what they were. For the record, my name is Representative Stan Bunn from District 29. Very briefly, originally when we were trying to put criminal information on police computers, I think we were saying to the citizens of Oregon, allow us to do this because we need it for criminal justice, and that's what we're going to use it for. And now somehow we've changed our philosophy, and we're saying once we get this information on computers, we'll put it out to the public for any purpose. I think the public is going to come back to us and say, if you're going to keep that kind of information on us, we said you could do it for criminal justice purposes. Now you're making it public for any purpose, and I don't think the public will buy that. The amendments address the question of employment. What about the question of credit bureaus, banks, insurance, the whole range of additional purposes that perhaps the public doesn't have the right to use the information for? I think it's crucial to recognize that you can't go into a police agency now and ask for this kind of information for employment purposes, for credit purposes, and I think the amendment is to try to placate those who believe the information should be confidential, and it only addresses one small area of the total problem. I think there's a basic fundamental difference of opinion as to the question, should this be public information or should it be used for criminal justice purposes only? And if you answer the question, it should be for criminal justice purposes only, then it should remain confidential. If you say it should be used for public purposes, then there's no reason for the amendment. You should go with the minority report. And I think it's a fundamental difference of philosophy and which direction you want to go. And on that basis, I see the compromise amendment as doing violence to either the minority or majority. They don't make sense, as I see it.
Next Wednesday, we'll have the majority, the minority, and the amendments on for work session. So those who are interested can be prepared for that. Meeting is adjourned.